I have confidence in what I do in my career. I've had it for a long time, but I did not know myself. And I was kind of a lost and wayward person on that front. And talking about the value of documentaries, our own Hiding in Plain Sight was the film that taught me how to search and find myself.
What does it actually take to build a filmmaking career inside the Ken Burns universe? And what happens when the hardest part is not actually the craft, but learning who you are? Today, I'm sitting down with Christopher and Eric Ewers. They're brothers, and they're filmmakers, and their new documentary series on Henry David Thoreau is coming up on PBS, and it features George Clooney, Jeff Goldblum, Ted Danson, and Meryl Streep. This is part one of a two-part conversation with the brothers, and you are gonna love it.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there, like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films, they elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host and a documentary filmmaker myself, Christian Taylor. And every other week, I sit down with storytellers from all over the world and every stage in their careers from all walks of life who share their stories with us so that they can help us all become better filmmakers. Now, one quick thing before we get started. If you haven't subscribed to our podcast yet, just please take 10 seconds and hit that follow or subscribe button right now, whether you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, whatever. It's really the single best way that you can support this show. So, all right, now, today I'm sitting down with a couple of really experienced filmmakers who also happen to be brothers. They've just completed a fantastic documentary series that I'm super excited to talk about. They are the Ewers brothers, Eric and Christopher. Welcome, guys. So nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
What I love here is that we have a sort of a friendly little rivalry. We've got a Cubs. Well, I'm really the Cubs fan, but we got a Cubs hat and a Boston Red Sox hat. I'm really sitting with two Boston Red Sox fans, right?
Yeah, this is a special hat because Chris and I, when we were filming in Chicago, went to a Cubs game and I fell in love with the stadium. It was just wonderful.
It is. Chris, you told me a fact earlier that I didn't know. What was that fact?
Yeah, Fenway was built in 1912. Wrigley was built a few years later, and they were designed by the same architects. Not only are there, you know, grandstand similarities, but certainly when you go underneath to concessions, et cetera, you know, they look incredibly similar.
Yes, and if you have never been to either ballpark, I highly recommend it. So oh, yeah. They are just an unbelievable place to visit. Of course, they're both fantastic franchises, and you know, I'm very partial to the Cubs. So anyway, all right, moving along. That's not what we're here to talk about. We are here to talk about your new series, which airs on PBS March 30th and 31st on Henry David Thoreau. And we're going to get into that in a few minutes. But first, I want to start with your bios because you guys are super interesting and I want people to really understand who you are. We're going to lay the groundwork first. So Eric has been a Ken Burns senior editor for 33 plus years, working on nearly every one of his films since the Civil War, which is a very long time. His path to Ken Burns started with a really lucky coincidence. As a UMass Amherst undergrad, he saw the Civil War in a dorm lounge and was moved to tears by none other than a pan of a photo of corn. He called his father, who was a Civil War buff, and he learned that his aunt and uncle lived next door to Ken Burns. Now, when does that ever happen? Pretty crazy. He's a multi-Emmy Award winner, and an Ace Eddie winner for the best edited documentary in 2015, which he'll tell us about in a minute. What was that? Can you remember now?
I believe it was The Roosevelts.
The Roosevelt, yes. One of my favorite documentary series. Also by Ken Burns. And he's become an expert across the full filmmaking spectrum, editing, sound design, music production, writing, directing. And he's based in the New Hampshire area near Ken Burns' Florentine Films production company. Now, before we go into Chris's bio, I do want a little bit more detail on this story about your aunt and uncle living next to Ken Burns and just the real details about how that actually happened.
It really... If there are moments in life when you look back and you realize that you were meant to do something, this is one of them. This beyond a shadow of doubt. The simple story is it is true. I was doing an internship with the UMass State Police and I was filming things with them, kind of like the show Cops. As a fifth year student back then, there was a lot of hard times in Massachusetts, so the educational system was a little challenged. I was there for 5 years, but I had no idea what I wanted to do. And all of a sudden, here I am watching during some downtime filming with the state police. I was watching this beautiful pan of an old photo of corn, and there was some traditional music playing and some battle sounds and a quote read by some actor in some beautiful way about experiencing the battle. And I stopped dead in my tracks. I was just enthralled. And I remember it like it was yesterday, because I literally said, oh my God, I want to do that. You know, my love of history, that came through my father. I just was like, I really want to do that. So of course, as soon as I could, I called my father and told him, and very casually he said, well, Ken Burns lives next door to your aunt and uncle in Walpole, New Hampshire. You should look into it. And fast forward a year later, and my aunt and uncle were deciding to sell their house. Ken's head editor, Paul Barnes, was wanting to move up from New York City. He bought their house under the following condition in the purchase and sales. It said, Paul Barnes wants the window treatments and the carpets. And then it said, my aunt and uncle will give those if he will accept me as a potential employee. So I started an internship. I graduated on a Sunday from UMass, and I started Monday morning at 9 a.m. And now 37 years later, here I am.
Unbelievable. I mean, that is absolutely a testament of fate for sure. Or God, but clearly who you know. I mean, in this industry, it all comes down to who you know, network.
I wish I could say it was some kind of, oh, I had these skills. My father said, your education started the day you started working for Florentine Films.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, and I told you my education started when I watched Ken Burns' Masterclass, because I had no idea how to make a documentary before I made one, and he's the one that taught me, so... that's pretty amazing. Now, Chris, I do wonder, did your brother have any influence on you at all?
Yeah, sure. I'm 10 years younger. I always, you know, I mean, we come from a very long line of creatives. There's not a lot of physicists, you know, or chemists in our family. In fact, I'd be surprised if there was a single one. But I always knew, I was always fascinated by photography. Always knew that if I had my druthers, I would grow up to do something behind a camera. You know, fast forward many years, Eric's working with Ken. I was in LA working out there, moved back to the East Coast. And, you know, we decided to, you know, join forces, combine our talents.
Yeah. I'm going to fill out your bio a little bit. You did say you're 10 years younger and you studied cinematography at Boston University and photojournalism, because you said you've loved cameras at New England School of Photography. You have 20 plus years behind the camera, spanning documentary films. You started with Burns since the Vietnam War. You've done commercials for Fortune 500 brands like Apple, Coca-Cola, Tiffany & Company, Stella Artois, Volvo, and Jim Beam. And you've done network TV. So You've recently shot your first narrative feature called The Disruptors, which came out in 2024. You're mm-hmm. based in the New York City metro area. So if anybody needs work, you know where to find him. And he has a very high-end commercial reel. So you guys need to check it out. We may even attach it here to this podcast so you can see it on YouTube. So this guy is a guy who operates in both worlds. And we're going to talk about this later in the film. In my opinion, he sets the high bar and a great example for how to be able to do what you are truly, truly passionate about. You make it possible by making sure that you can live in order to do what you're passionate about. You can cover your bills. Anyway, together you guys made a production company called the Ewers Brothers Productions, and you really sit in a unique position. You're a preferred collaborative company within the Burns Florentine Films ecosystem, and you co-direct under the that banner. You've done some other films, The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, and Science, interestingly enough, even though have you no scientists in your family, which came out in 2018, and also Hiding in Plain Sight, Youth Mental Illness, which came out in 2022, also a science film. You grew up in Holliston, Mass. Now, what I find interesting about these three films, and we could talk about this just a little bit now, but there seems to be, including with this one you just completed, a real concern and compassion for sort of the greater good, for humanity. And I see this real love of people and a deeper concern for us as people and a society. Would you say that? Is that accurate? Or do you have another way of, articulating your mission behind your films?
I think Chris and I know we both want to answer this. I think we both never imagined what kind of filmmaking we'd make when this first started happening. Ken helped cultivate our company with side projects, outside ventures, things like that. Very enthusiastically endorsed us, as long as I didn't quit my day job as an editor. And I think what started to happen is Chris and I both had the emergence of our own particular bent or style that we wanted on our films. And we gravitated, given the subjects, towards contemporizing the history that was involved in the stories and making it more relevant, more directly relevant today. And I can speak for myself. I never envisioned it going that way, but it allowed it to become a mission for us, where we both have had and endured mental health challenges in our families, in ourselves, in our past, and how we could ever realize beforehand how much of a profound difference working on that film would make for our own lives and our mission.
Yeah. I mean, if we had our druthers, we'd be making films about musicians and music and other artists, for the rest of our career. I think that both of us are very passionate about creation. That said, we're also highly attuned to the human experience, right? The human experience is the key to relatability, right? Regardless of what the topic, be it politically, socially, even in an advertising sense, right? So social issues, sure, they can be hot topics, very contemporary. But when you take that conversation and you create a foundation of underneath it of history, the fact, irrefutable facts, real change can occur. We can start to have a real conversation. We have this platform, filmmaking, television. I feel like we have a responsibility. We feel like we have a responsibility to use it, to hopefully engage in worthwhile public discourse.
I think that's absolutely beautiful. I did a podcast earlier, and I've shared this with you, where I talked about the science of sticky memories and where we do have a responsibility as filmmakers to realize we have the power chemically to change people's brains as we combine music, sound effects, visuals. It changes the chemistry of our brain and begins to reform how we think about things when you put that with ideas. And we do have the power to do that. So that gives us a great responsibility for how we build that. And so I think that's a beautiful idea. And you demonstrate that, I think, masterfully in this new film about Henry David Thoreau. And I want to read a little bit about sort of the summary of that, if you don't mind, and then we can kind of dive in. I want to know how this film came about. It's a three-part, three-hour documentary. It's your first full-length, the first full-length documentary biography ever made about him. And it is airing on PBS, once again, March 30th through 31st. The first 2 hours will be on the 30th, and the second one, or the third one, will be on the 31st. Now, it's executive produced by Ken Burns and, interestingly, Don Henley. I want to know how that happened. He is the founder of Walden Woods Project, which, of course, makes sense, but I don't even know how that happened. It's narrated by George Clooney. Jeff Goldblum voices Thoreau, and Ted Danson voices Ralph Waldo Emerson. Meryl Streep voices multiple women in Thoreau's orbit, and Tate Donovan, he voices William Ellery Channing. Now, the film goes well beyond the Hermit at Walden Pond narrative, and it positions Thoreau as a fierce abolitionist, a critic of consumerism and industrialization, a champion of civil disobedience, a prophetic voice about environmental degradation, themes that feel, eerily contemporary. I said that to you earlier. And it features an incredible host of scholars. This is produced in partnership with Florentine Films and WETA in Washington, D.C. It's got an original score and incredible funding by the Better Angel Society, Jeff Skoll, the Mansudo Foundation, and a host of others. So you heard me say there, I'd love to know how this all got started. And I think I read you did a short version for a museum on Henry David Thoreau, perhaps. So talk to me about that, why Don Henley is connected, and then just how this project all came about and why you were so passionate about it.
I think the best way to start is the moment of creation. When I was working, I can't even at this point remember what project it was on, my day job editing with Ken. And the phone rang in the office, and it was Ken. And typical Ken, he said, "Hey, pal, got a quick question for you. Would you and your brother be interested doing a short film on Henry David Thoreau? And Walden Pond, his experiences at Walden Pond for their new visitor center that they're building. And you'd be working with Don Henley from the Eagles." And I kind of missed a beat in my heart. And I was like, yes, we'd love to. And he said, "Oh, good, because I already volunteered you for it." Which is so Ken, his enthusiasm for filmmaking and for us was just amazing. And there began this journey that started, actually, that was in 2015. And it took us a couple years to make that film. And it really was as simple as just putting a bug in both Ken's ear and Don's ear and saying, this is only a small fraction of his story. If anything, we're just focusing on the one and only thing that people know about Thoreau. And there's so much more.
And it was only 20 minutes, right? That one was really short.
Yeah, 22-minute film. And it really turned out very well. Chris, you remember when we first started walking around Walden Pond exploring? It was kind of scary.
In what way?
Well, Thoreau himself describes it in writing as, nothing special, right? I'm going to misquote him, of course, but he says something along the lines of it's an everyday pond in a very normal or typical Massachusetts woods. It's not like the way that he writes about it, one would expect, the Great Salt Lake or, some magnificent vista where it's impossible to not be introspective and to feel small and to, to take notice. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, that is hilarious, because I was going to say, from what I watched, I just kept thinking, I can't wait to go there. It's the most beautiful thing, because it's shot so beautifully. And, he talks about the magnificence of it. It's just mesmerizing. So it's just a pond.
Yeah. It's drab, but it was that was the interesting bit. We were taught Thoreau. We were taught Walden, at very least in high school, very poorly, I might add, and I think in order to read Walden or to read Thoreau, I think that it helps to have some, some road under your feet, right? Some life experience. So
good.
We go there and we're walking around and we realize that we're going to have to heavily lean in to how, to his process, right? To Thoreau's, the way that he writes about it, the way that he the way that he writes about the things that he did. So we kind of figured right out of the gate that we were going to have to look at this place and these these details through Thoreau's lens, you know, rather than ours. And in doing so, it really opened us up to, you know, the beauty that we've been missing.
And to clarify real quickly, I think it's important. When Chris was talking about Thoreau saying it's just an ordinary place, what he was referring to is how the masses, how society would see it. They would just walk by and say, oh, it's a pond with some woods with a lot of down trees. And it wasn't, it was the fact that Thoreau made a choice to live simply and deliberately and to look at things in a different way with a different emphasis. And the challenge was for us who, you know, I don't know if Chris passed in his Thoreau paper in high school. I got it like a C minus. My teacher said it lacked insight. You know.
Well, you passed now. I'll give you a passing grade now. You got more than that. You got an A+.
For two very unlikely individuals, that day I remember we were walking around going, how are we going to make this come alive? And when we say we, I'm a casual observer and occasional commenter on Chris's cinematography when we're out shooting. I provide suggestions, but he is the one who looks through that lens and says, I'm going to see the Jacob's ladders of the sun rays coming through the holes in a leaf on a tree. And that's what Thoreau would have seen. That's what the people walk by and rarely see or stop to see. And one quick mention, they have school trips there all the time from local schools. We went there as kids.
I was suspended. I missed that trip.
I went on that trip and it was just a field trip to get out of school. I remember, to be dead honest. But what we were told was now young kids come through the visitor center. They sit down in the little theater. They watch our 22-minute film. And the park rangers have told us how the kids scramble to line up to get across the street because they're so excited to go and explore based on what they saw in the film. And I hope that opens a world to them that they maybe are not seeing.
Well, I
mean, then they get over there and then they're like, that John Denver was full of shit, man. I thought the Rockies would be a little rockier.
I got to tell you, you did do a masterful job. And I said this to you offline. What I absolutely could tell from the first 10 minutes is you took your own individual gifts, you know, of cinematography and of sound design and editing, and you married them in such a powerful way because those are some of the strongest elements that brought this to life. Mm-hmm. And I particularly noted the sun rays and the way that you caught those, not just through the leaves, but through the forest. There's so many different ways you caught those rays of light in every different way, through windows and on floors and in canopies. And it was just, it was marvelous. And it reminded me, you know, I did a lot of shooting in Normandy, and one of the most, you need to go there. Chris, I have to take you there because light in Normandy just is so captivating. It's the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And the things you can do with it are remarkable. And that is the way I felt like. I felt like I saw that kind of magnificence with the way that you treated the light in this film. And you did that with the water as well. Like, it just looked so beautiful. And your film, it has this, and Ken Burns films do this a lot. It just invites you in this lovely, soothing, it's like, come in and hear my story and let me, I don't know, it's just this open lap that you sit into and you go on this journey with you. And the sound effects, as well as the sound design and the score, just compliment that beautifully. So I applaud you both. You both get A pluses, whether you were suspended. I don't know what for, but you know, maybe now you paid much better attention clearly when you went back. Now, you both said you love music, right? Well, was that like, were you stunned to learn that Don Henley was the one asking you to do that? And were you meeting somebody that you kind of had a great affection for? I see the guitars in the background over there.
Yeah, Don, it goes without saying, if you're around our age and have a pulse, you know the Eagles and you've experienced the blessings that that band has bestowed upon us for our entire lives. I mean, I don't think a day goes by where I am not seeking to hear the Eagles, but I do. Whether it's in the car or in a restaurant, it's just, it's pervasive. And I also find every time I hear it, I listen because they're so beautiful. Yeah. So there is an inspiration that comes out of a creative like Don Henley that came into this project without a doubt. It's very surreal, to be honest with you. But the funny thing is, and I think the wonderful thing is that Don certainly would prefer not to talk about the Eagles in our presence. He wants to talk about Thoreau. He wants to talk about English.
How did that happen?
He's been a rock star for so long. And I think he wants to be known not just as one of the front men and the drummer of the Eagles. I think he wants to be known for something else. And I think that is part, especially looking back, I think that's a large part of his life from the late 70s, early 80s, where he started this mission to preserve Walden Pond and to preserve the nature there and to preserve Thoreau's legacy as a writer and a person. He has been doing that ever since then to this day. And it's a passion of his. And it was a privilege, honestly, in every way, shape, and form. His involvement in the project was so valuable and still.
So he started the visitor center. He's from that area. No,
he studied. He was an English major in college. Fell in love with Thoreau. I think the story goes that, you know, he lived in Texas at the time and saw a news story about the woods around Walden and how they were in danger of being developed. So he and Kathy Anderson are great friend and incredible partner in this endeavor. They co-founded the Walden Woods Project, which at that time was simply a nonprofit designed to purchase or to buy up, protect and preserve the land, the historical lands in and around Walden Pond. They were successful then. And of course, the Walden Woods Project's mission has grown ever since. They've been absolutely crucial in the success of this project, even the creation of this project.
Hmm. Yep. Well, it's remarkable to me. I mean, I wonder, did he write a lot of the lyrics, in the Eagles music? And was that based in like his English and passion? Do you know any of this? And, because, Thoreau is such a deep thinker, and there's a lot of that in the Eagles music. So I am curious about that. Anyway.
I think on the short film, we had a chat because we interviewed him for the Walden Visitor Center film. And I remember asking him the question later in the interview, how has Thoreau influenced his career as a musician? And I seem to recall that he said that Thoreau was an influence and that what Thoreau taught him was a sense of place and that he so admired how Thoreau would ground you in a place in his writing that in some way, shape, or form, and I don't want to speak for Don, but in some way, shape, or form, that was part of what he tried to bring to his songwriting.
You speak about grounding in a place. And Chris, one of the things that, again, just stuck with me is your images that you shot of his place that he built right by Walden Pond, where he lived for 2 years. There was also Ralph Waldo Emerson's home. And I am curious, were those sets that were created, do those live there by the pond? Was that set design? Or tell me a little bit about that, because they were just shot so well and so beautifully. It just came to life.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So we had unfettered and really unbelievable access to so many of the historical sites in and around Concord. The Emerson family was incredibly gracious. Not only did we shoot interviews there, several interviews in the house, which was very special. We also, to your question, we also used the physical space in the house, the parlor, the lounge, Emerson's study, to do, I wouldn't say recreations, right? Because that's not what it is, but they're sort of abstract, interstitial cutaway bits that we filmed with a lot of of actual artifacts, Emerson's actual, possessions. In other cases, for instance, Thoreau's cabin, obviously the original structure has long since been, come and gone. But the visitor center has a replica cabin of, so to speak, built on the premises there. And granted, it's next to the parking lot. logistically, it was a challenge to film.
Well, it looked like it was in the woods.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there are a couple of angles where we can cheat it, right?
Okay.
You know, and of course, you know, it's built with modern materials, so we tried to minimize, you know, the establishing as much as possible. But we had we had incredible historical, you know, art directors for all intents and purposes for art department, who came in, researched, were familiar with Thoreau and the time period, researched and collected, you know, furniture and accessories and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, as likely Thoreau would have had. And then we were able to set dress the replica cabin at Walden Pond and film, you know, in a couple of different seasons in there. But I mean, again, we were, the access that we were given was unprecedented, and truly the reason why we were able to, you know, to try to create this world for the viewer to,
another thing that I really loved what you did, I mean, I'm assuming you did this, but you really did a wonderful job of shooting his diary. Did you do that? Did you shoot his actual diary?
So his journal, those journal pages were photographed. I personally didn't do them.
Okay.
One of our producers, Susan Shoemaker, and one of our post-production supervisors, Dan White, they were responsible for actually going to the archives where these, you know, these materials are kept. There's, I think, three or four of them. One of the major ones is the Concord Free Public Library. But they went in and actually photographed the pages, you know, with the archivists, you know. So what we're looking at are actual pages of his journal, though, mm-hmm. you know, we had to manipulate them.
Yes. So that tells me the editor had a hand in this.
Oh, yeah.
Because if they were photographs, then the editor was busy making those look wonderful. And another mm-hmm. thing I loved, the effect of you had the visuals that you had shot, whether it was over the lake or in the room, and you would blur in and you would see his hand starting to write in the upper mm-hmm. corner. I loved that effect. And I love how you guys tried to figure out interesting ways to keep the viewer engaged with not a lot. I mean, you had talking heads mostly the way throughout. You didn't have a ton of archival images, really, to play with. And you had his journal. I mean, there really wasn't a lot. And there was a lot of cinematography, I felt like, to keep us interested, which was good because we needed that, I think. Yeah, wasn't that a challenge to figure out how you were visually going to carry 3 hours of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the best part, though. You know, the constraints of the project, you know, I mean, photography was in its infancy, you know, when Thoreau was middle-aged. There's two portraits of him, you know, two usable photographic portraits of him. Very little, if any, of the spaces in and around Concord. So it required us to, you know, use our imagination to plug the holes. You know, Eric is masterful at not only, you know, cutting this together, but also helping to direct like what is needed for each scene. So, I mean, we didn't, you know, we weren't just shooting willy nilly. We were very calculated about our shoot days and what it was that we were going to capture and where it was going to be used.
Yeah. Eric, talk to me about that. How did the script kind of come together? Did you write this together? Did you put it all in your mind and say, okay, this is what I want for the edit, or what I need for the edit is this, and you came up with a shot list? How did it go?
It's such an amazing process, and I've had the privilege of witnessing some of the best doing this for film after film, dozens and dozens and dozens of film working for Ken, like writer Jeff Ward and Dayton Duncan and Ken himself sitting alongside. And I never realized how much I was absorbing. And we have a writer, David Blistein, and he is one of Ken's best friends from the early days of Hampshire College.
Hippie days.
David, yes, back in the hippie days.
The bridge, that far back?
Yes, that far back.
Before,
Brooklyn Bridge. And David is a love. He is one of the Ewers brothers, as far as we're concerned. I spent many, many, many days over the course of 5-6 years on all of it, from Walden to the full film, at his place in Brattleboro, Vermont, brainstorming and talking and helping him, giving him the direction on writing. And then, you know, traditionally we would have screenings with Chris. And Chris and I both kind of complement each other beautifully because he's so visually inclined. And I'm more the pieces, parts. I am visual, but I'm also the pieces, parts, the picture, the sound, and the music, and the story. So we couldn't have a better balance. I was one of two editors on it. Ryan Gifford was the other editor on this film. And, you know, really, I always see it as a jigsaw puzzle where you don't know exactly what the picture looks like on it. It's just a shape. And you're trying to take different shapes, which are the different components that come from whether it's Chris's cinematography, whether it's archival imagery from the University of Wisconsin or some local historical society on Cape Cod. You get these unrelated images and you have to see how they'll fit together one after the other. And sometimes they fit beautifully, sometimes they don't, but they fit okay. And the process is just for a year or more sitting with all of these materials and saying, hey, you know, this one fits a little bit better here. All of a sudden, two images from two archives that are thousands of miles apart suddenly help tell the story better. And the premise is always to keep your viewer in a place. That's how you bring them through a journey of someone's life. You say, okay, here we are in his boyhood, which we chose to do a lot of paintings.
Yes,
from that time period.
That was so great. There was one particular one where, I don't know, maybe the narrator or a talking head was talking about them sitting on a branch, maybe. The boys, the brothers, were sitting on a branch. You did that a lot. You would zoom in. And that is a Ken Burns technique. I've seen that a lot, where he will, you know, use these paintings and just little pieces of those paintings to describe. It's genius when you have nothing, when you have nothing else.
And it's so funny because I've read a lot of the critics of Ken over time, and they say he's always doing the long pan and the tilt and staying within the images, to which I, usually speaking to myself or barking at the thing I'm reading, I said, well, what options do you think there really are? If you're trying to tell a story that's back in time, pre-photography, and, you know, it's like if the image works and serves the point and keeps the viewer engaged and intrigued in the story, then it works. And
that's somebody who doesn't understand visual storytelling clearly.
You know, everyone can make their own film and everyone would make it differently. And that's one of the things Chris and I really have learned over the years as directors, is that we have to stick to the vision that we collectively agree on. And it might not be other people's visions of how to make the film.
Okay. You talk about you both being directors. So now I want to know, true truth. How do two brothers co-direct? Give me the down and dirty.
How do we define that one?
I
it's
mean,
really messy.
All right, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, you know, if you get married.
Yeah.
You understand that, like, okay, this is a partnership. It's forever. You're not always going to agree. Sometimes you're going to fight, right? But the idea is that over time you figure out who you are and who the other person is, even if, you know, it's like, even if you're related to them, right? But you figure out, like, okay, if I do this, I'm going to get this response, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, it was not easy in the beginning for, you know, by any stretch of imagination. And, you know, some people just can't do it. I mean, Ken and his brother originally started out making films together and realized that it just wasn't going to work for them. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think it helps immensely that, you know, that we both also have secondary responsibilities, you know, for the film. And I think that over time we've just found the middle ground and creatively and emotionally.
I think we also, like, we've learned, and it's still a work in progress. We've learned each other's lanes. There are certain aspects of filmmaking that I am supremely uncomfortable with. And those are, you know, unfortunately, for this podcast, secrets between us, but there are certain things that I just know I'm very uncomfortable with. And it's, I believe, no accident that he is. And I think there are certain things that he is very uncomfortable with. And to learn how to rely on each other to bring the A game to things, It works almost seamlessly now, I think. I think when there's certain thing comes up, I'm like, Chris has got this. I don't have to worry about it. And he does the same thing. And that also includes like cinematography. I can't tell you, like when I say I go as a director with my director hat on to B-roll shoots or an interview, I know that I'm there to suggest only. It's his vision, the way he wants to capture. It's his expertise. It's what he's spent his life doing. And I remember the early days when we were working on our film on the Mayo Clinic, I walk into a room, I said, Chris, film this and this and this. And he'd look at them and he'd say, no, I don't. And I'm like, what do you mean? No, I know I need those. And he's like, it's not going to look good. And if it's not going to look good, it's not going to hold up. And if it doesn't hold up, viewers won't be engaged by it. And I think there was some bristling at, you know, same with editing, when he'd come to me and say, I think this should be this, this should be that, and in this order. And I'd be like, not really, you know, because here's the reasons. And we worked through it very quickly, I think. And now sometimes we don't talk for a week or more with all this stuff constantly going on, because he knows I got that and I know he's got that. So that's the part, I think, that is the secret sauce between the two of us. The emotional stuff we've worked through. We love each other and we care about each other and our families and our work, our expertise. All joking aside, because God, we could start slinging shit back and forth.
Well, you are brothers after all. I mean, I live in a house with five men. I know how that goes. Love is the closest emotion to hate that I have ever seen. So, but what's amazing, what I'm hearing you say, is that it really is important in filmmaking, it's true in life, to really know yourself, to know who you are and what you are good at, and then to know what your partner is good at and respect them and give them that freedom to own what they are good at, and you know, and the freedom to operate in their lane, like you said. Yeah. So I mean, I think it's beautiful.
It's an important point. I mean, anybody who's been in the industry and is successful in the industry, obviously they know this, but you know, to others that don't or new to the industry, I mean, like, you know, this is a team effort, you know, like filmmaking is, it takes a village in order for it to be good, right? Nobody, you know, when a producer gets up on a stage and accepts an award for, you know, for that, for whatever project they were a part of, it always pisses me off when, you know, they thank the studio and the, you know, all of the glad handing and, you know, and necessary like obligations, the obligatory thank yous, and don't recognize the fact that, you know, those people wrote the check. It was the hundreds, you know, dependent upon the size of the project. It's the tens that, you know, or the hundreds of people, you know, who are very good at a very specific thing that all come together to work as a team, to collaborate creatively, which is incredibly difficult for some people, but absolutely crucial to the filmmaking process. You know, none of us get to where we are or where we're going by ourselves. It just does not happen. So, you know, to understand your lane and to master it and let somebody else master their lane is absolutely fundamental to, you know, to the whole process.
And I got to say real quickly, you talk about knowing yourself is such an important, I think, for people who watch your podcast to try to gain knowledge and wisdom from people who have been in the business. That struck a very strong note, you saying that, and I appreciate it, because I want to tell you, I have confidence in what I do in my career. I've had it for a long time, but I did not know myself. Mm-hmm. And I will say, all joking aside, in all seriousness, my brother, given his life circumstances, has always known himself. Mm-hmm. He's always known who he is. And he brought that leadership to our collective team, and he gave me, and I stress the word gave me the opportunity to know myself and to find out myself. And I mean, don't want to get over philosophical or sappy, but you know, I think that's one of the most important parts of life, is to really know who you are and what you expect of yourself. And I was kind of a lost and wayward person on that front. And talking about the value of documentaries, our own Hiding in Plain Sight was the film that taught me how to search and find myself. Countless of millions. And Chris gave me the opportunity. That was our toughest hill to climb as brothers, but it happened. And I'm forever grateful for that. So very important point that you make.
And how Thoreauvian of you.
You know, I appreciate you bringing that out, honestly. I've started doing a series, and I'll follow this podcast up with it next week, called A Deep Dive. And I guarantee you it will be on this, because this is so crucially important. I started my film company, and one of the things I've always said is I wanted to do production differently. I've been in this industry over 45 years, and I've seen how it's just ruined people, ruined relationships and marriages and people's health. And I feel like it is possible to be in this industry and to create beautiful art together and become better people if we do it in a way that is sustainable. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It is supporting one another and bringing out the best in one another. And, you know, it is, we have to create that environment for one another, and that supportive place where we can encourage one another and spur one another on to love and good works, and where iron can sharpen iron is what you're talking about. And I think that can't be understated. So people who are listening, this is a beautiful example in these brothers' relationships of something that I feel like I was a teacher for 10 years. And I think all of these things, whether it's athletics or whether it's filmmaking or a theater class, those things are just tools that we can use to become better humans. And so that's what I hear you saying.
Yeah, the outside barrage, the outside world, outside of your film company, outside of your personal life, your internal thoughts, that's ceaseless. That's never going to stop. It's always going to be there, whether it comes from your own team, whether it comes from people completely outside of that. It's knowing who you are inside that allows you to be the leader that can say, you know, this is what I want. And the thing that's so great about brothers in a company or sisters is that you have the opportunity to, like he mentioned, a marriage, you have the opportunity to develop that collective wisdom together. You borrow each other's strengths, and you have to be willing and humble enough to see that there are other people who are stronger than you in certain areas. But that leadership role of being a director, other than being an editor first and learning what makes up a film, which really made me a better director, right there, right next to that, is also understanding who you are, how to lead. And that was a process for me.
Yeah, I love the humility and being honest about that. And I think one thing I have noticed about Ken Burns's company and the people that are in his orbit is he has chosen people that he trusts and respect and that have, it seems to me, this same value and kind of work ethic, and that can create this environment in the production company. And I think his work reflects that. And he's continued to like multiply himself and multiply that kind of Thoreauvian mindset, you know, beyond himself.
All right. I'm sorry. I know I hate to do this to you, but I do have to pause because this conversation went on so long in the best possible way. So we have decided to split it into two episodes, which really is phenomenal because you're going to get to hear them talk for a whole nother almost hour. Now, what you heard is only part one. So I'm going to do a little bit of recap. These are two brothers who have spent decades inside the Ken Burns filmmaking universe, and they have now stepped into the director's chair for their new three-part PBS documentary series on Henry David Thoreau. Now, In this part one series, we heard their origin stories and how Eric ended up working for Ken Burns through what might have been the luckiest real estate deal in documentary film history. We'll forget that, probably in any history ever. And how Chris built a career behind the camera shooting for Apple and Coca-Cola and Tiffany before coming home to documentary. And how these two brothers learned to co-direct together, which honestly was not easy. And they were refreshingly honest about that. We also landed on something that I think is really important. This idea that knowing yourself is foundational to being a good filmmaker and a good leader. Eric shared something deeply personal about that, and I don't want that to get lost. It's real and it's really important. It matters. Now, next week, I'm going to release a deep dive episode where I unpack some of the themes from this conversation. So if you haven't listened to our deep dive episodes that come out every other week, make sure you check that out. If you're a Patreon supporter, you now realize that you're starting to get all of our episodes early. So you might consider joining our Patreon. It's patreon.com/documentaryfirst. You'll get everything first. And then following this week's episode, part two, actually, we'll do the deep dive next week. And then part two of their interview drops. It's a very different animal. We get into the business side of the PBS documentaries, which is something filmmakers are always asking about. And we talk about the state of the industry right now, AI, funding, the shift from broadcast to streaming. And Chris has a really grounded, Thoreauvian perspective on all of it that I think might surprise you. And then we get incredible stories about how they landed Jeff Goldblum, George Clooney, Meryl Streep, Ted Danson. So these stories are totally worth the wait. Trust me. Their documentary series of Henry David Thoreau is available on PBS, wherever you stream PBS content, or if you have cable still, it's on your PBS cable channel. And I'm going to strongly encourage you to watch it. It's beautifully made. And Thoreau's ideas about how we live and what we consume and what we owe each other are shockingly relevant right now. So it'll make part two of this conversation even richer for you. All right. So I'll see you next week for our regularly scheduled deep dive. And then the week after that, I will see you for part two of this conversation with Eric and Chris Ewers. Got it? Lastly, two other things. One, if you would be so kind, leave a review. I do read them all, and you will help me become a better podcast host, as well as help other filmmakers who really want to learn things to find our podcast. And number two, share this podcast link with a friend. We'd love to meet your friends. Thanks so much. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.